Some of you have been coming to the class on the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha's descent into Sri Lanka, where he expounds upon the teaching of nothing other than mind, amongst other topics. And we've been exploring the different realms of consciousness that the Buddha teaches in that sutra. And there's many things scattered through this sutra, and many which we won't get to in this class because it's a long sutra and there's many things and they're scattered in various ways. So tonight I'd like to bring up this one of these short teachings kind of wedged between some other teachings that kind of stands on its own. And it's about the Bodhisattva spirit, the compassionate spirit of the Bodhisattva that runs through this whole sutra, but is brought out very explicitly in this section. And it's, as we get into this, you'll see that to me it seems like this section of the sutra has a kind of Zen flavor. It almost sounds like a koan, this story. So it's based on the teaching of what we call the Icchantika. Has anybody heard of Icchantika? Then this is a great opportunity to learn this obscure Buddhist term, but that crops up here and now in various places. It's a strange concept, a kind of disturbing concept. But the sutra will, I think, liberates the concept from its disturbing nature. The concept of Icchantika. Icchantika was apparently taught maybe for the first time in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra, which is one of the definitive sutras teaching Buddha nature, or Tathagata Garbha, along with the Lankavatara Sutra, so they're related in that way. Very, very long, much longer than the Lankavatara Sutra. And this term Icchantika means something like a hedonist. Something like a hedonist.
And you think that's disturbing?
Well, that's not the disturbing part. No. Hedonist. Like, someone who's just totally indulgent and doesn't care about anybody else or their own liberation or anything, but just having a good time. And they, you know, I think the sutra defines them as something like they don't believe in cause and effect. And this is something that in the early Buddhist teachings is called wrong view. The right view is basically, the conventional right view is basically believing in the workings of cause and effect, and karma particularly is cause and effect as it works through living beings with intentions. So basically that, you know, doing something really self-centered as a cause, as an effect of like unhappiness for ourselves and others. The basic teaching the Buddha taught a lot in the early sutras. And doing something that's in the direction of more selfless activity and for the benefit of others and not so self-indulgent leads to happy, peaceful, joyful effects for ourselves and others. So hedonists could be those who just don't believe in that principle. It's like, it doesn't matter. Just like, whatever. Let's just do it. It'll all work out. So kind of like, I'm not really wanting to look at how cause and effect works. Something like this, apparently, is the meaning of this Sanskrit word, ichantaka. But the way that it's used in this Parinirvana Sutra is that, and this is the kind of controversial, disturbing part, is that in some versions of the sutra, now, it's so disturbing that when they translated this Indian sutra into Chinese, it seems like some people couldn't actually handle this disturbing quality of it, so they actually translated it differently. But some translations of the sutra say that the ichantaka basically has like cut off the possibility for Buddhahood. It's like almost like they have no Buddha nature. And we're not just talking about, you know, a little self-indulgence. It's, I think they're talking about, sometimes it's brought up in connection with these, the five heinous crimes that are like, you know, killing one's parents, for example. You know, even killing another person isn't as bad as killing one's parents or killing an arhat, you know, an enlightened saint. And these, you know, really horrible, hedonistic deeds that are the negative karmic effect is so great that like even throughout countless lives they'll never be able to work off the karma. I think it's kind of the implication in the sutra. They're like sometimes Buddha nature is taught as like a seed, potential of a seed to become a Buddha, and it's like in the sutra it's compared to like a scorched seed. Like a seed that was burnt, so its very DNA structure of Buddha nature has been like ruined or something like that. It can never grow. So in the Mahayana, this is right a very disturbing concept that any being does not have the potential for Buddhahood. That's what the great beauty and radical teaching of the Mahayana Buddhism is, that all beings, no matter how much trouble they've caused, have this potential to be Buddhas. And not only that, but some sutras even say that they will become Buddhas. Not just potential, but it might take a while, right? For some people, but like the Lotus Sutra, it's constantly making these predictions of the Buddha in the Lotus Sutra, is making these predictions of Buddhahood and say, you will be a Buddha with such and such a name and such a time long from now. And he makes these predictions for like the lowest of the low, like Devadatta, who in the stories of the Buddha's life was the Buddha's cousin who tried to kill the Buddha. And and once, you know, tried to push a rock onto Buddha, and a splinter of the rock cut Buddha's toe, and a little blood came out. I think actually drawing the blood of a Buddha is one of these five, like, heinous crimes. And so Devadatta did that, right? He's maybe the only one ever who, like, you know, with anger caused blood to flow from the Buddha's body. So, but nevertheless, Devadatta gets this prediction of Buddhahood by the Buddha. That's the spirit of the Mahayana, but there's this little obscure teaching of the Ichantaka, where, like, and maybe it's just a warning, right? It's taught as like, you know, if we're too forgiving here, then people might start killing their parents and say, ah, we'll become a Buddha anyway. So maybe it was taught for this reason, to just like, you know, just be careful, don't go too far, okay? You know, take care of cause and effect. But it looks like then some other people translated the sutra into Chinese and changed that around a little bit to say that even Ichantakas have these, haven't cut off the possibility of Buddhahood. So that's the background of Ichantika. And then this sutra, which was probably appeared in the world a little later than the Parinirvana Sutra, has this section about Ichantikas. And section 22, and the Buddha says, as for Ichantikas, Mahamati, if not Ichantikas, who in this world would liberate them? So that's the first teaching. How do Ichantikas get liberated from suffering? By Ichantikas. As for Ichantikas, if not for Ichantikas, who in the world would liberate them? So we're going to hear a little bit more here, but you can keep this in mind, that Ichantikas will be liberated from all their suffering and karmic effects and so on by other Ichantikas. There are two kinds of Ichantikas, Mahamati. Those who forsake good roots and those whose vows regarding others are without limits. So this first kind sounds like the kind that the Parinirvana Sutra is talking about. They forsake good roots. Means like wholesome roots from wholesome karma is this term. Red Pine's note says, good roots include thoughts, words, or deeds of compassion and wisdom that give rise to this fruit. Good fruits. Good roots give rise to good fruits. Like Buddhahood is a great fruit. And this first kind of Ichantika forsakes good roots. Like they don't care about wisdom and compassion that leads to Buddhahood. That's the kind that's the classic Ichantika. But there's this other kind, which is those whose vows regarding others are without limits. So, Bodhisattva Ichantikas. So why are they called Ichantikas? Strange, huh? Two kinds, as taught for the first time in the Lankavatara Sutra. Two kinds of Ichantika. Mahamati, what is meant by forsaking good roots? This refers to slandering the Bodhisattva canon and falsely claiming it's not in accord with the teachings of liberation in the sutras or in the Vinaya. So it's a little Mahayana plug here that maybe in these days of emerging Mahayana, when there are still these early schools of Buddhism that were a little more conservative and didn't get into this radical Bodhisattva thing so much, they sometimes would say, and still today, some people in these more conservative schools say, all these Mahayana sutras like the Lankavatara Sutra, that's not a Buddhist sutra. So, as is the case today, so is the case when these sutras were first appearing, and there's this great, great compassionate value in these Mahayana sutras. So, in this case, forsaking good roots means slandering the Bodhisattva canon. It means like Mahayana sutras, and maybe we could say Mahayana Vinaya, which would be like the Brahmajala Sutra, the source of our Bodhisattva precepts. It's from a Mahayana sutra. Slandering the Bodhisattva canon and falsely claiming that it's not in accord with the teachings of liberation in the sutras or the Vinaya. The sutras are the, as you know, the teachings of the Buddha about all kinds of things, and the Vinaya is the precepts, teachings. So they say, well, they might even, some people might slander the Bodhisattva precepts, and in fact, I think some might, even in present day, because they say that's not the Buddha's teaching. That's not the Vinaya that's practiced in all these other Buddhist countries, in these non-Mahayana countries. There's many people who practice in non-Mahayana traditions that don't slander the Mahayana. They keep their way and they honor the Mahayana too. But forsaking good roots, in this case, is slandering the Mahayana teachings of Bodhisattva practice. Because they forsake their good roots, they don't enter nirvana. So, this is the first kind of ajantika.
Sounds like excommunication.
Yeah, kind of excommunication.
Because of sectarian reasons.
Well, we could say sectarian reasons, or we could say just cause and effect. That actually, slander and great compassion, I mean, we could say it's talking about particular sutras, or we could just say, those who say, like, this bodhisattva thing is kind of extra, this great compassion stuff, just this liberation for me here and now, it's everyone for himself, go for it, I'll see you guys later. That kind of attitude, you know. That's how I would, you know, symbolically I think that's what it means. We could hear it as maybe sectarian, but I hear it as slandering these teachings of great compassion, that of, we could say, universal liberation as opposed to individual liberation. And that's just like, not so much that that's like the sutras will come back and haunt you or something, or the Buddha will strike you down in some magical way, but just pure cause and effect. It's like they cut the roots of great compassion, actually. And they maybe, they could maybe even enter like a Shravaka Nirvana, but they couldn't enter Buddhahood, because Buddhahood's based on this incredibly great compassion. That's how I would understand this. So that's the first kind. So it's a little twist off the original Achantika definition, is they forsake the good roots of, you know, being kind to others and so on. This puts an even more Mahayana twist on it and says they forsake the good roots by slandering Bodhisattva teachings. Next are this other type of ajantika. They are Bodhisattvas whose practice includes the vow not to enter nirvana until all beings enter nirvana. Right? That's the classic definition of a bodhisattva. Is that it's based on great compassion, and it's great compassion that wants to free everyone from suffering, and the way to completely free everyone from suffering is to guide them, carry them across to great nirvana, which is perfect, unshakable peace and complete freedom from suffering. That's the bodhisattva's vow, not just to help beings a little bit, right, but to carry them all to nirvana, perfect peace. And they vow not to enter nirvana themselves until everybody else first. So bodhisattvas whose practice includes the vow not to enter nirvana until all beings enter nirvana. That's the second type of ajantika. So part of this thing is that the ajantikas, right, are part of their definition is that they're the ones who are incapable of realizing Buddhahood. And we could say here, we could start to maybe equate this with realizing complete nirvana of Buddha. They're incapable of that. The first kind's incapable because they cut off the good roots by slandering bodhisattva practice. The second type's incapable because they're bodhisattvas and they're not going to enter nirvana until all beings enter nirvana. So they're actually incapable of entering it. So that's like a bodhisattva ajantika, right? It's like turning the whole original meaning in this amazing way. But there's more. Yes.
But they're still coming from this platform of this ajantika concept.
Yeah, but it's a completely new meaning now, right?
But then what's the ajantika-ness?
The Achantikanis is that they in a way have sort of cut off their possibility for Buddhahood, because they're not going to realize it until all beings realize it, which, you know, maybe will happen sometime, but it's going to take so long for all beings to become Buddhas that it's virtually, let's say virtually, they've cut it off.
But what's the difference between that and a non-Achantika Bodhisattva who also has that same vow?
Nothing.
That's what I wanted to.
It is just another name for Bodhisattvas. But it's like redefining. That's how I understand it. It's kind of redefining Achantika from the most horrible thing it could possibly be. So horrible that people couldn't even stand to translate it the way it was written in the Indian. Like I said, you know, the most disturbing concept they make into the greatest possible thing. That's why I think it's kind of like, that's what I mean by the kind of Zen flavor here. It's like turning the worst possible concept into the best possible one. Instantly. There's two kinds, though, now. There's two kinds of Achantika. Take your pick.
It seems like it's a little bit of a warning, though. Like, if you're about to do Jukai, it's like, make sure you're really ready to step across this line, because it's going to be a long time.
Yeah. It could be like, forsaking your... If you really want to become a Buddha, or... you know, realize complete, perfect nirvana quickly by yourself, you may want to skip Jukai. Yeah, and you know, do some non-Mahayana precept reception. Yes.
Somehow this reminds me a little bit of Shantideva.
Shantideva
always takes a concept, or sometimes takes a concept where you're really sure what it means, and leads you down the path to agree with the conventional meaning, and then he turns it around.
Yeah, and Dogen does that, of course, too, a lot, right? Yeah, yeah, turning, you know, there's skillful means right there, and, you know, turning our fixed idea about Achantika on its head. And but regarding this, you know, whether or not you want to do this, Keizan Zenji, many of you know, the author of The Transmission of Light, the Denko Roku, a few generations after Dogen, considered, along with Dogen, one of the two founding ancestors of Soto Zen. In Keizan's autobiography, he has a kind of like year-by-year autobiography, and he doesn't really elaborate on this, but he just says in a certain year, he says, at age 25, he'd already been practicing for a while, and he said, at age 25, I made the great compassionate vow, just like Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, of an Achantika. And when I read that, I was like, huh?
Wow.
And there was no commentary. I was like, he made the vow of an Achantika? Like, to be the most evil, despicable person? And now I see that maybe it was even based on the Lagavatara Sutra. Or maybe there's other teachings like this too, we don't know about. So Keizan vowed to... be an Achantika in this type. But there's more here too now. If you start to feel sad that if you make this vow that you'll never realize this great thing called Nirvana, so Bodhisattvas whose practice includes the vow not to enter nirvana until all beings enter nirvana, are the second type. However, Mahamati, what they mean by entering nirvana is characterized by not entering nirvana. So they vow not to enter nirvana until all beings enter nirvana. We're all about like, okay, these people are going to enter nirvana, and then maybe I can enter nirvana if they all enter nirvana. But actually, what they mean by entering nirvana is characterized or has the characteristic of not entering nirvana. Thus, they too follow the Ichantika path. So again, it's like almost like just a little line of koan or something with no further elaboration. But we could say that, you know, how are we going to actually bring all beings to nirvana and maybe even ourselves? In the Mahayana, in the teachings of emptiness, the characteristics of nirvana are of no nirvana, right? Nirvana has no characteristics. Ultimately speaking, there is no nirvana for anyone to enter, them or us. So therefore not entering nirvana may not be such a bad thing. How are we going to enter it anyway? Yes.
I was almost just thinking that this Ichantika Bodhisattva is almost like the ultimate Bodhisattva, because if you're a regular Bodhisattva, you're like, well, everybody's going to go, and then I get to go. But if you don't even get to go, then it's just, there's nothing else but service.
That's nice. It's like the ultimate Bodhisattva.
It's like sacrifice.
Complete sacrifice.
That part of it, and then I get to go.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean
Right. And then, on top of all that, then we get this little teaching that we can contemplate for the rest of our lives of that nirvana is actually no nirvana.
So you're not really missing out.
Not really missing out. Yes,
Is it also the same practice and realization, or the same?
How so?
Well, if you think nirvana is someplace else rather than the practice of right now,
if we think nirvana is someplace else rather than the practice right now, we're missing it, or we're making it into something. That's true. But also, if we think that the practice right now is nirvana, that's also putting characteristics on nirvana. So we have to be careful all around not to call it any particular thing. Even to say that, well, what's realization? It's just practice. Ultimately, it's no practice either. So Mahamati then asks, Bhagavan, then which of these two never enters nirvana? So this is kind of nice here too. Which of the two never enters nirvana? We might think that both never enter nirvana, but actually the Buddha says, Mahamati, Bodhisattva Ichantikas are the one that never enter nirvana. They know that everything is already nirvana.
Hey, what is person?
Therefore, how can they enter it? But they're also careful not to say, since everything is nirvana, then this right now is nirvana. Like we have in some classic Zen sayings, like to say it's this misses the mark. But Bodhisattva Ichantikas know that everything is already in nirvana. Not just people, right? But everything. Which some other sutras say, all things are quiescent from the start, naturally in a state of nirvana. It says in the Sandinirmochana Sutra, from the ultimate perspective. So these Bodhisattva Ichantikas know that everything is already in nirvana, thus they never enter nirvana. It's about entry here, right? How can you enter something if you're already in it? This is not true of those Ichantikas who forsake their good roots. And we could say, it doesn't say this, but we could speculate that if they were part of the Bodhisattva canon, that they disparage, what was it?
Slander.
Part of the Bodhisattva canon that they slander is the teaching that all things are quiescent from the start, naturally in a state of nirvana. You don't find that outside the Bodhisattva canon, those teachings. So therefore, they might actually have to do this thing of entering nirvana. It's going to be hard work. But they get to do it. The Bodhisattva Acharyas don't get to enter nirvana, because they're already in nirvana, along with everything else and everyone else. But these other non-Mahayana Acharyas, they can enter nirvana. A Mahama, and we might say, well, what about the forsaking the good roots part, right? Now we have that problem. They get to enter nirvana, but I thought that they forsook the good roots. So how will they be able to? So there's another little teaching here. Mahamati, even though they forsake their good roots, through the power of the Tathagatas, at some point their good roots reappear. Yeah.
It's actually quite an optimistic.
It's a very, very optimistic little piece, yes.
Restocking of the storehouse consciousness.
What's that?
Restocking of the storehouse.
Yes, restocking the storehouse consciousness. Or like Asanga, one of the first expounders of the storehouse consciousness, says, well, the storehouse is just filled with dualistic obscurations and delusions. He says, how could we ever realize Buddhahood? And he says, this is something like remember we have this word vasana, permeation, or Red Pine translates as habit energies, which maybe doesn't work so well in this case, but this permeation of perfect wisdom from, like, the pure Dharmakaya actually enters the storehouse consciousness. Just like all these other permeations from all our karmic actions are constantly are being planted in the storehouse consciousness, this is one little seed that gets planted of, like, perfect wisdom from the realm of reality, the Dharmadhatu. So that's you could say that could be a little that could be Asanga's way of talking about how this works. Through the power of the Tathagatas, at some point their good roots reappear. This wisdom seed is planted from the Tathagatas. Or the Tathagatas are not some beings outside us either, right? Because there's no such thing as anything outside us. But mysteriously, in our connection with the Tathagata, such a seed could appear, and good roots reappear. And how so? Because Tathagatas do not forsake any being. This is why Bodhisattva Acharyas do not enter nirvana. I guess that's just the concluding statement. So there's many things going on here, right? These two kinds of Acharya. And then the Bodhisattvas don't enter nirvana because they see that everything's already in nirvana. The non-Bodhisattva Acharyas actually do get to enter nirvana, ironically, because the Tathagatas actually don't forsake them. It's kind of going against this early teaching previous teaching that their seeds are burnt forever. It's kind of like, no, the Tathagatas don't ever forsake anyone.
They're not damned.
They're not damned, yeah. It's the...
That's a very profound expression of redemption.
Mm. How so?
Redemption. You know, it's just that you will be redeemed no matter what.
Yeah. By the Tathagatas. And again, like, who are these Tathagatas if they're not outside ourselves? And, you know, to, like, Buddhas can't, like, kind of zap us with good roots. But Buddha nature, which the sutra will later get into, Tathagata Garbha, as it's called in the sutra, you know, the womb or the heart of the Tathagata is right here in or as every living being, completely undefiled and undisturbed by all our unwholesome roots. Actually, they don't touch it, right? So it's just because of the power of this Tathagata Garbha, this pure, unchanging Buddha nature, replete with all Buddha qualities from the beginning. It's just not unfolded, not manifested. But because this is here, it's possible then to become manifest. When the in a way you could say it has more power than the unwholesome roots that obscure it. So eventually it will shine through. Now, if that wasn't weird enough, just a little Zen commentary on the Chantikas, maybe kind of along the same lines, from Dogen's "Going Beyond Buddha" essay, but he's actually quoting here an old Chinese Zen teacher. Zen Master Kumu of Jingyin, Dongjin, whose initiatory name is Fa Cheng, an heir of Furong. Furong is Fuyo Dokai, one of the great revivers of Saodong Chan. So he's an heir of Furong, taught the assembly, "As I know about going beyond Buddha, I have something to say." So there's a connection here now between going beyond Buddha, which is kind of like going beyond attaining nirvana. "As I know about going beyond Buddha, I have something to say. Answer now, good students. What is going beyond Buddha? This man has a child who does not have 6 sense organs and lacks 7 consciousnesses." So
that's the answer from the students?
No, they don't answer, so he just answers himself. "This man has a child who does not have 6 sense organs." So we've been studying a lot about the 6 senses and the 8 consciousnesses. So there's no explication here, but maybe we could say, you know, the 7 consciousnesses are the first 7 is everything but the storehouse, right? So maybe he's not denying the 8th storehouse consciousness. So this man, I assume he's referring to himself, you know. "This man has a child who does not have 6 sense organs and lacks 7 consciousnesses. He is a great Ichantaka, a kind of not Buddha. When he meets a Buddha, he kills the Buddha. And when he meets an ancestor, he kills the ancestor." So you've heard about killing Buddha in Zen. Talk about, that's one of the 5 heinous crimes, right? Killing Buddha, killing an ancestor. "The heavens cannot contain this person. Hell does not even have a gate to let him in." "All of you, do you know this man? This is the great Ichantaka, the not Buddha." In other words, going beyond Buddha. Killing the Buddhas when they meet the Buddhas, killing the ancestors when they meet the ancestors. Can't enter heaven can't enter hell. Hell does not even have a gate to let him in. You know this one? Chantika vows anyone like to make? Or any comments, questions? Yes. Yeah, and then we have to see clearly how it is it. I mean, we can take it on faith, on scriptural basis, you know, because the sutras say so, but doubts may arise, right? So how do we clarify that everything is naturally in a state of nirvana? Quiescent from the start means like nothing's moving or coming and going ultimately. And yet, it's quite obvious that everything is appearing to come and go, not be so quiescent, and not be so peaceful a lot of the time. So we have that conventional truth that it's hard to deny that appears before us every moment. So how can we verify the ultimate truth of quiescence? And when you said we make these bodhisattva vows, what then does it mean? We say Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Does that mean like Buddha's, to become Buddha's way, we have to not become Buddha's way? Could we say I vow to become it in parentheses, not to become it?
Well, I always used to think in younger days, dharmically speaking, that I was in an effort, an ongoing sustained effort to become something that I really was not yet. Mm. I no longer see it that way.
Yeah, the vows have that kind of setup built into them. Let me just close with this. We were talking about the four bodhisattva vows last night, some of us in the Warming the Jewel meeting. And I was saying how sometimes I can feel like this like there's this real problem, like this doubt arises, like, really? How could we possibly do this, you know? And as we discussed this and people brought out, well, it can only happen in this inconceivable way. So this is the Huainong, the sixth ancestor on the four bodhisattva vows. You maybe heard this before. First he just recites the four vows. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. And then he says, good friends, as for beings are numberless, I vow to save them. It isn't Hui Neng, me, who does the saving. Good friends, every being you can think of saves themselves with their own nature in their own bodies. Really, like, does it relieve the burden or increase the burden on us? That's the question. What's that?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. The burden's not an issue.
Yeah.
What does it mean that they save themselves with their own nature? The wrong views and afflictions, the ignorance and delusions in their own bodies already possess the nature of original enlightenment. That's what we're talking about, is Buddha nature. It is just this nature of original enlightenment that saves them with right views. Once they realize the wisdom of right view, they dispel their ignorance and delusion, and each being saves themselves. The ignorant are saved with wisdom. The bad are saved with goodness, and the afflicted are saved with enlightenment. Those who are saved like this are truly saved. The Platform Sutra, yes. So, I don't save them, and yet we vow. I vow to save them. We understand in this way. So without looking so deeply, it seems like it can seem like big doubt, big problem, big burden. And then by investigating a little deeper, we can see how it could be possible. And then with complete, thorough examination and non-conceptual, inconceivable dropping off body and mind, your body and mind as well as the bodies and minds of others drop away. No trace remains. May all beings arouse the great vow, the Icchantika, and never, ever enter nirvana. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. Surpassable. I vow to become it.